And we're back with the final segment of Broad Appeal, Julianne Moore, The Good, The Bad, and The Crazy. I'm Brian.
I'm Sean.
Sean, I have one question for you. Did he fuck you in the ass, poor El Culo? Well, did he?
Who are we talking about?
That little puta. Ladies and gentlemen.
Living in Lambeth, there's a few putas. I wouldn't be able to tell you which one exactly.
Ladies and gentlemen, perhaps no actress goes to the extremes of Julianne Moore.
And no other actress gets such devilish line readings like she does. The great thing about The Crazy is that it becomes very easy for Julianne Moore.
In the last couple of segments, when we've looked at Crazy in Grease 2 and in Theodore Rex, it was sort of the films that were crazy, right? Kind of off-the-wall camp or misfires, or just insane ideas.
Yeah.
The Crazy that we've picked here is a film that in many ways is very, very good. It's Savage Grace, directed by Tom Kalin.
Yeah, which, from 2007.
Yeah, which is the story of Barbara Bakeland and her son Tony, these very wealthy mid-century American socialites, rich people who have a mother-son incestuous relationship, and then Tony ends up killing his mother.
And that is the film.
That is basically the film. But why is it crazy? I suppose one answer is that the characters are actually crazy.
Yes, I think that is the way to view everybody who appears on screen. I mean, the story itself is crazy.
It's apparently true?
Yeah, it's apparently true. It's based on the book Savage Grace. So obviously, it's been liberties taken, but yes, it's based on the story of Tony Bakeland and his incestuous relationship with his mother and the crazy family therein. I mean, the story itself is almost straightforward family melodrama, isn't it? Apart from the weirdos that exist in this particular family.
I don't know if anything about it is straightforward. I mean, honestly, Tom Kalin, I think, if not his first, certainly his most famous other film, is Swoon, which is about the Leopold and Loeb murders, and he's associated with the kind of new queer cinema that also Todd Haynes is associated with, who obviously has a really long-standing relationship with Julianne Moore.
Yeah, I think Tom Kalin did an awful lot of filming of ACT-UP demonstrations, and he did a lot of work with Grand Fury as well. That was kind of his interim period.
Amazing. It seems that in his fictional film work, he is somewhat preoccupied with gay psychology and sex and death, this weird perversion and murder and sexuality.
Well, see, this is why I love new queer cinema.
Mm.
Because you get very often these incredibly slickly designed stories to tell, but they're also full of these very clever transgressions. And also, you can always tell when you're watching a film directed by a woman or a gay man, because you just get much nicer shots of the male body as well. And Brian, come on, we're invested in a medium which is still dominated by straight white men, that when you see a male body that's treated lovingly and erotically, it does make you think, wow, that's amazing. It stays in your mind.
It makes me think, God, I never knew Mandy Patinkin looked like that.
Oh my God.
Go back to the Yentl episode.
Thank you, Barbara.
So to get back to Savage Grace, both you and I have seen this movie before. It was a rewatch for both of us.
Yeah, I saw it in 2007 in the Lighthouse Cinema in Dublin with my friend Connor Barry.
I saw it at the IFC Centre on Waverley Place in The Village, which is a lovely place to see it. That cinema, I think, it's now the IFC Centre, but I always will think of it as the movie theater in Six Degrees of Separation, where Wisa goes to find Paul Kittredge, but he's gone. He's disappeared.
Did I see Clouds of Sils Maria there?
Yeah, we both saw Clouds of Sils Maria.
We did.
Memorable. But anyway, before we get into Savage Grace itself and Barbara Bakeland, the character that Julianne Moore plays,
point of information, this film supports my theory that everybody called Barbara is insane. Okay, sorry to interrupt, I just needed to put it out there.
What about Barbara Bel Geddes?
Maniacal.
Okay, well, anyway, we'll leave that to Barbara's to deal with. But before we get into Julianne Moore's character and this film in particular, I'm really glad that we picked this film because it's a lesser-known example of a Julianne Moore type, yeah? Which is the crazy sexual woman maniac. I think for a long time, Julianne Moore was respected, but maybe pigeonholed in roles that had a sexual adventurousness and mania, maybe.
Well, I mean, Boogie Nights, of course, her first Oscar nomination, and even The End of the Affair, which isn't... It's not a big sex movie, but it is an erotic, you know, story.
There's a sex scene on a stairwell with Ralph Fiennes thrusting to the Michael Nyman score that is definitely not decorous, shall we put it that way. So Julianne Moore, you know, from the aforementioned thing we mentioned in the other segment, in Shortcuts, where she's, you know, full frontal nudity.
The Big Lebowski, where she flies through the air nude.
Yeah, and of course, even in the same year that she won for her beautiful, loving portrayal in Still Alice, the id of Julianne Moore was on display in her other great role of that same year in David Cronenberg's Maps to the Stars, which you loved.
I loved, and you didn't. Is that right?
No, I mean, I didn't totally think that the movie worked.
The movie felt strangely dated, because we found that script had been milling around for a few years.
Julianne, who won the Best Actress Prize at Cannes that year for playing crazy aging actress... What's her name?
Havana Sigrand.
I mean, honestly, like, she is just phenomenal in that film.
Yeah.
When people talk about Julianne Moore being fearless, it's like she will be sexy, but she'll also play scenes where she's just like sitting on the freaking toilet with her, you know, panties down at her ankles, and she's not afraid to be sexual, but also comic and also pained and fragile and damaged. And her other work with Paul Thomas Anderson, like scenes in Magnolia and all that stuff.
Oh,
like,
I love that scene in Magnolia.
Yeah, but what I'm just saying is, like, Julianne Moore goes there. And that is why, I mean, I can totally understand why Cal and Liv have not seen most of their mother's work. Or at least they hadn't, you know, up until a certain point. Maybe they've seen it now. But, I mean, if your mother made these kinds of movies and then came home to, like, drive you to soccer practice, like, it might be hard to square the circle there.
If I was the son of Julianne Moore, I'm not going to rush out and see the film in which my mother fucks her son.
True. Yes. Okay, so this is a movie that's all about mothers and sons, and gay sons and their mothers.
Well, so that's why I loved it so much, darling.
So, in this pantheon of insane, crazy Julianne Moore sexually adventurous roles, where does Barbara Bakeland sit?
She's somewhere between Havana Sigrand and Carol White, I think.
So Carol White in Safe is a woman who is kind of trapped in a society and a role that kind of has destroyed her entire personality.
Yeah, in her plush palatial mausoleum home with her pristine Beverly Hills vacuous life.
And just a fear of sort of everything around her.
Yeah, that slowly loses it.
Yeah. And Havana Sigrand is similarly a woman who has everything.
Oh, and she inhabits a world of absolute chaos.
And she just acts out in every possible way. And this is the amazing thing about Julianne Moore, isn't it? She can be repressed and internal. She can be totally normal. She can be funny. But there is sort of something about her when she just lets it rip. And from early on in this movie, Barbara Bakeland is a provocatrice, right?
Yeah, I actually really like this character.
Why?
Well, it's partly the way she plays it, you know? Because as the film goes on, you think, oh my god, Barbara, please. That's what you think. Like,
why?
Because she becomes impossible. You realize that even among a group of crazy people, she's full-blown mental.
Well, and they're crazy because they live in this hermetically sealed, airless world of the mega-mega rich. So
the whole world's their playground.
Yeah, the Bakeland fortune has been made a couple generations before. Her husband, Brooks Bakeland, is the heir to this kind of form of plastic, right?
Yeah, the fortune has been reduced, we find out, but it's nonetheless still definitely there. And they move within those very grand circles where it's not so much socialites or entrepreneurs they have, and with as much like,
you know, Prince Bernhard.
Yeah, Austrian crown princes from, you know, the Tyrol or something. I don't know, but that's the type.
You never totally learn exactly how she entered into this world. She worked at Filene's, so she was a working girl. She was an actress. At one point, Stephen Delane, as Brooks, says to Tony, "Your mother was an actress, and in many respects, she still is." And in that way, I guess that explains something about Barbara, that she has put on this role of extreme wealth. So even at the beginning, when she's dressed in the nines, they want to go out to the store
club. I love this bit.
What bit? When she's on the phone?
No, well, not just, yeah, well, that bit too.
So she's on the phone calling her various social elite friends and saying things like, "Shall we have dinner at 10:30? Is that too continental for you?"
Which, you know, I'm going to start saying now.
"Please forgive the intrusion and the damnably short notice, but we are having late supper tonight with Midge and Juice Vanderhoevel, and they would so like the pleasure of your company. They'll be delighted. As will I. As will Brooks."
She's doing all that. She's like playing up in this completely arch and artificial way what it's like to be, you know, a rich socialite.
But then there's also that scene a moment later where she's bathing her baby boy, Tony, with her mother, and it's all like, oh, what a beautiful baby. Oh, I love him. And as she's about to leave, she realizes that her sleeve is now wet, and she goes, oh, fuck.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is like, she'll go from this decorousness to this rage that just bursts out. So she'll be hosting a bunch of European intellectuals, you know, Spanish and French literary types, and she'll be saying things like, "Do you truly believe that Proust was a homosexual? Qu'est-ce que tu penses?" But then, like, a moment later, when they kind of insult her in French, because she's forced her son to come out to the dinner table and read in French from Justine, and they're all horrified, and she says, "How typically fucking French, they tell you how to raise your child, and then the next moment they're looking at your ass. I know what you were saying." You know, so she has this kind of like coarseness that just bursts out, no more so than in the amazing scene in the airport in Mallorca, where Brooks has finally kind of had enough of her and has run off with his son's girlfriend, right? The Spanish girl, and they're gonna leave her, and that's where she just comes screaming about the putas and the culos.
"You are truly disgusting, do you know that? You and your little Spanish cunt."
"You're speaking too loudly."
"I am speaking of a cunt. Half your age." She looked at Tony, looked at you, thought for about 5 seconds, cinco segundos, and said to herself, "Ah, that's where the money is. Entiendes? You go on and on about your grandfather and the life of the fucking mind. I go away for 1 week and what do? Something very intellectual indeed. Oh, does he fuck you up the ass, por el culo? That's what he likes, you know. He thinks it's very manly. I think quite the opposite."
I mean, there was a time after seeing that movie that I just couldn't even enter into an airport without wanting to scream those lines at the top of my lungs.
Why?
Because it's just so much fun. Like, I guess this is why you like this character, because it's fun to think that you can be a person who can get away with all this shit. Well, I mean, really, she doesn't get away with it.
That's an interesting point.
She is psychologically destroyed.
Yeah, like, this is why you can go. This is it exactly, okay? This is the character, at least, of Barbara Bakeland all over. She's both so fun and so coarse and so unpredictable. You think, wow, she's great fun, let's go along for the ride. Until you have to live with her and deal with her.
Yeah, and so we haven't talked a lot about Tony, who is played first as an infant, then as a small boy, in an amazing performance by some... I mean, how old do you think that kid is?
Well, he was 14, I believe.
He looks so young.
Yeah, he's a child.
He looks like he's about 8 or 10. And he's just so arch and odd and otherworldly in those scenes between him and his mother. You know, saying things like, "I just felt as small as a lima bean. Oh, I absolutely do love boulets, don't you?" You know, this kind of very camp Faye. And fey yeah. and overly
studied,
pampered yeah. kind of way that he and his mother have just become too close and too intensely into each other. And she's saying things like, oh, we're very privileged to be able to do what we love without having to labor, without having to work, you know? I mean, you're sickened and disgusted by these people, but you can't look away from them on a certain level.
The ultra-rich with manners are fascinating. But Barbara Bakerland, it's interesting. So Barbara Bakerland is new money. Well, she's no money, masquerading as new money, masquerading as old money.
Mm.
And I think that's what makes her interesting. She's playing the game and then she's enforcing the rules at the same time.
Tony sort of shows his sexual proclivities towards boys even when he's very, very young.
These scenes, they are provocative, you know?
Well, describe how that comes to pass.
Well, let me describe the scene. So, after the Justine incident, the father leaves and checks into a hotel only for hours later, a very seductively dressed Barbara to turn up to seduce her own husband.
She looks like a whore. She's kind of a come into his hotel.
Come play there and get down.
Yeah. Kind of. Well, and get on all fours and oh, take the culo. You. Poor el culo. Yeah.
Poor el culo. Does that mean for and by in Spanish?
I just say anyone who speaks Spanish, the prepositions, it's impossible. It's impossible to understand which preposition is which.
Fair enough. Okay.
And any person who's a Spanish speaker, they can never explain the rules. They're just like, no, you have to.
Yeah,
know
but
it.
That's English as well, you know. Anyway, the next day, the Bakelands return home, all happy and loved up. They walk into the room and they see what is it, a young person's body in their bed, and they assume that it's Tony until they hear Tony's voice calling them from another room, on which they realize that that's not their son, that's some other neighborhood boy.
Francois.
In their bed.
Basically, I mean, it's never fully explained, but the idea is that he's been left alone and he's invited over a boy for a bit of hanky-panky. And these kids seem really young.
But also, like, just how provocative it is to for the parents' bed, you know?
Yeah. It's interesting the way that that moment is played, because the boy in the bath feels totally nonchalant about having invited over another boy for, you know, sexual experimentation.
Well, we assume it's sexual experimentation.
Yeah.
But this is the beauty of it, by my own estimation. The parents think it's sexual experimentation, but they also hope it's not, and then they're wondering if they're right in doing
but
so.
But what I'm saying is, it's not, they don't have the same reaction as one another. So,
oh, yeah.
The father is absolutely horrified, but then there's lingering shots of Barbara staring at her son. She's a straight woman who loves sex with men, but she also has that fascination with the homosexual. And in some ways, the fact that her son is gay draws him even closer to her. It's weird. She sort of wants him to be a man, but she also loves the fact that they can share this appreciation for male bodies. And that only gets more fucked up when the boy grows up to be Eddie Redmayne. Amazingly, of course, Julianne Moore and Eddie Redmayne won their Oscar in the same year.
I hate that.
Why do you hate that?
You know why? Because she had to slave for fucking years before she wins an Oscar. He grows up 10 years, gets nominated once, and wins. You know,
I understand what you're saying. But Eddie Redmayne actually has put in his dues. Like, he's not an overnight star. He's done a lot of work. And also, it's a very rare thing for an actor that young to kind of pop up and win a Best Actor Oscar.
Yeah, that is true.
Eddie Redmayne is talented, like, and I think actually rewatching this movie reminded me that he is really well matched with Julianne Moore.
Oh, physically and just in terms of their on-screen chemistry, for sure.
They have that resemblance that is believably mother-son. But also, I mean, he's well matched with her in the sense that he will go there so that while she's playing this crazy, unpredictable mother, he feels like an exotic plant that's been grown with the kind of the wrong food that's made it delicate and weird and unviable in the world, and he looks and speaks in a strange way.
It's twisted towards the sun, you know, in a strange way.
The way I'm talking about this greenhouse thing, it's making me think of Suddenly Last Summer. I think I said to you at one point when we were watching that this is like a Tennessee Williams plot where all the subtext has just been made text. Like everything about this is just like, it's just like in your face, like over the top. I mean, can we just enumerate some of the crazy things that Eddie Redmayne and Julianne Moore get up to as mother and son?
Well, first of all, there's the permitting of his sexy relationship with that very sexy Spanish dope smoking beach rat.
Yeah, he's great.
Tony, Jake.
You might have knocked.
I did. No, I went to the airport today to pick up Sam. Who should I see but your father? We had a word or two, I can tell you that.
You can tell me. You are telling me.
Don't get harsh with me.
I'm sorry.
Are you defending him? Are you taking his side?
You must have had a long drive. Why don't you sit down and let me pour you something to drink, okay?
If he had just stayed smoking reefer on the beach with a sexy tan Spaniard, I mean, we could all do worse than that. But instead, he abandons Udax, doesn't he?
Yeah, and then he gets off with his mom's GBF.
Yeah, Hugh Dancy. You were really into Hugh Dancy.
Let me tell you something. I am into a particular kind of English guy. Like, I'm not really into English guys so much. The thing about Hugh Dancy, though, is that he doesn't have that weird, angular face that a lot of English pretty boys have. He has this kind of, like, friendly, round, soft-edged look about him. In the dapper clothes that he's put in.
High-waisted.
Yeah. He looks both benign, but also fun.
Fun is an interesting way to put it. He's a kind of terrible camp effete social climber who kind of leeches off of Barbara and Tony, manipulating things behind the scenes, and he ends up seducing Tony.
And seducing Barbara.
And then ultimately the three of them end up in bed together.
Yeah.
He's just slept with the mother, the son crawls into bed with them, and then they all wake up the next morning, kind of look at each other, and see the comical, absurd, taboo situation that they've gotten themselves into, and they just all start laughing and kissing and making out in a incestuous ménage à trois.
Yeah.
So that is the movie that this film is. I have to admit that while I can appreciate the craft of this movie, it's beautifully shot, it's edited in a surprising way, the cinematography is constantly keeping you off balance, it's very spare, it like takes you from crazy incident to crazy incident. It's one of these movies that I have to ask myself, why has it even been made? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, it's a chronicle of horrible people doing horrible things, or, you know, the charitable version would be damaged people. But they're so far in another world from anything that I know or can relate to. I don't feel that this film has any anchoring in anything I can care about.
Don't you think that the new queer cinema often, you know, kind of revels in presenting various transgressions on the screen? I mean, like, Todd Haynes did it in Poison.
Yeah.
Greg Araki has pretty grotesque depiction, especially in things like, what's that one?
The Living End.
Yeah. And there is a sensibility that is kind of like, we're going to be hypnotic and paranoiac and...
Yeah, and Genet has that quality, which is a huge influence. But what I'm saying is, like, those other films that you're mentioning, Poison and The Living End and whatever, I mean, in a lot of ways, they are stories of marginality, right? Particularly in the heightened context of the AIDS crisis, where there's a precariousness, there's a quality of, especially in The Living End, but like, let's fuck everything, let's fuck all the rules because we've been fucked over by life and the system. You know, there's like a recklessness, yeah?
Mm.
I feel like you can relate to that because you can relate to people sort of pushed to extremes. But this film is just people to whom everything has been given. I mean, it's not unlike we were saying about Uncle Vanya, like the idleness.
Yeah.
Like, it's like they have absolutely nothing to do other than spend money, like, results in moral rot.
Well, would you not view it as the new queer cinema take on the period drama, you know, of the gentry, of the elite, you know, the tribulations of the ultra wealthy?
What is queer about this movie is, I guess, what I'm saying. Like, I know queer content, but like, doesn't it bother you just how reprehensible everyone in this movie is?
Not as much as you'd expect, really.
And this is what I'm saying, like, this movie is campy fun.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is fun to watch Julianne Moore and her son sleep with a sexy guy and, like, call other people a puta and do all this stuff.
And enjoy the destruction of people's lives.
I don't know, maybe it's my Catholic asceticism, but there's just something in me that's like, well, this is all very fun, but, like, what does it all amount to? And, like,
hey, I'm a Catholic too.
Should I be enjoying this?
Oh, come on. It's Schadenfreude.
The more that we talk about it, because what we haven't done is we haven't talked about the final movement of the film, because it gets darker and darker.
Quite quickly, in fact.
Because actually, in the aftermath of being left by her husband, she tries to commit suicide in a horrible way, using
suppositories and a razor blade.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I never even heard of sleeping suppositories. Do people still use those?
I think I got one when I was in hospital once.
Goodness.
It was good.
So she does that, and then poor Tony has to, like, care for her.
Yeah, he says he inherited his mother.
Then they end up going to London, and the cinematography changes quite dramatically.
Yeah, it becomes bathed in this pond scum green lens.
Dinginess.
Yeah.
And that's,
suddenly everything smells like mold to me.
And by that point, both of the characters have sort of decayed to their absolute worst selves. And this is the scene that just makes you want to crawl, your skin crawl a bit. So he's sitting there in a finely tailored Savile Row suit.
That, like, he just got, you know?
Looking like he has absolutely nothing to do. And they're having this completely, you know, what's the word? Slack-jawed conversation with one another about the tailoring and blah, 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 and this and that. And I don't think you should be hanging out with young Timothy if you want to be a man. And then she just reached down and touches his crotch and says, oh, that's interesting. I guess some part of you is responding to me. And then, like, in this weird mechanical way, climbs on top of her son and just gets fucked by his cock.
Do you think this is the first time they've done it?
Well, you mean that he's fucked her? Because obviously they've spent time in the bed with the other guy with them.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is, do you think in this interim period that they have just started sleeping with each other? Or not even, I'd say sleeping with each other, that's giving it too much credit. Do you think they've started just, like, fucking each other?
I don't know. I mean, the implication seems to be that this is not a shockingly new thing for them from the way it's depicted in this London scene.
I think that he knows that it's not the dumb thing to do, but nonetheless does it anyway. When she's riding him and she says things like, did you come? And he's like, no. And then she just gets off and just jerks him off.
And moments later, he kills her.
Yeah. Because he can't find the dog's collar.
I mean, by this point, Tony is seeing hallucinations. He is obsessed with strange things like the lost collar of the dog that he loved, Giotto. And the killing, I mean, it's truly horrifying because it seems so random.
Yeah, it's so cold and so random.
It doesn't seem like he's premeditated a killing of her. He just decides to stab her. She lies dying in a pool of blood, and he goes to order Chinese food.
Mm-hmm.
And more or less the movie ends, and we get title cards explaining that he spent some time in prison. He came out, his grandmother took him in, and then he killed his grandmother.
No, he didn't kill her. He just stabbed her.
Oh, she didn't die?
She didn't die.
Oh, sorry.
But he went back to prison as a result.
And died.
By his own hand. This is where I understand where you're coming from, with saying, what's the point of this?
Yeah.
It's like, I've been on this journey with Tony, but Bakerland and his mother. She's dead. Now he's dead. And what have I gleaned from this?
And this is the thing, like, I'm just wondering, Tom Kalin in telling the story and all that, I'm sure there's tons of gay cineast boys like us who have watched this and, like, giggled and laughed and loved, you know, Julianne Moore's campy line readings and the sexy threesome and all this stuff. And then the rug is pulled out from under us by this horrible ending, and it's just like, is this just meant to make us sick that we enjoyed the stuff that came before?
Yeah.
Is part of the explanation for these two people who get destroyed, are they both just victims of the patriarchy? Because who is the absent figure there? It is the alpha male father, Brooks, who, like, leaves them and abandons them, and then they're this damaged woman and this damaged gay boy who really are longing for the father.
Yeah, but can I say, though, that Barbara does enough to drive her husband away because she's an appalling person.
No, I know, you know, I mean?
Like, I'm all for blaming the patriarchy for things, but, like, she's just a terror. She's an absolute disaster woman.
isn't he the ultimate villain?
No, I don't think he is. I really don't.
He abandons him completely, will not talk to his aunt. I think that the narrative structure implies that Tony's descent into madness... Because Tony, while weird and effete, is not mad until after abandoned by the father and having to take care of his clearly...
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Manic mother, then ends up trying to see the father. The father ignores him. He buries a letter to the father in the flower bed.
Well, I would say that Brooks is guilty by absentia.
Yeah, he's a lacuna in their lives. And you know what I say? Lacuna matata.
Oh, God, I knew you were going to say that. I was hoping you wouldn't, though.
We've been talking for a long time. Yeah. Okay, I guess I would recommend for people to see Savage Grace.
No, I would absolutely recommend it, because the thing is, you know, you don't get films like this very often. And when you do...
Thank God.
No, but when I'm saying, when you do get the... Because I think these films are interesting to see, because they are evolving, they are interesting. And look, you and I, with Hannibal, it was very easy, because we had these very severe reactions to it, where it was just bad. But these are the more interesting conversations sometimes, because we can say, is it good because it was enjoyable, or good because you got something out of it? What did it mean? Did it mean anything at all, you know? And also being completely off the wall. Like, I appreciate these kinds of films.
It's a vision. It's a visionary film.
Yeah, and also... Also, this is why Julianne Moore gets the credit she deserves, because, first of all, I'm sure she was integral to getting this film made in the first place. And who else could you see handle that role with such aplomb? And the thing is, you don't hate Barbara.
There's only one other person who could have done it. It's your other favorite actress.
Michelle Pfeiffer.
Isabelle Huppert.
Oh, yeah, of course she could have done it.
No, honestly, because they both have that thing where they can just flip a switch and move... in these different modes. And frankly, I'm sure Elle is a version of this character.
Well, this is the thing. When Elle came out, we were like, well, it'll never be made into an American remake, but if it were, who would do it? And the only person we really could fit on was Julianne Moore in 10 years' time, perhaps.
You know? But they both have that thing where they just feel so in command of their instrument. They just take a script, they take a character in all of its contradictions, and they go 1,000% in any different direction without feeling the need to psychologically explain or connect the dots.
And thus...
and thus, we have spanned the three faces of Eve, or rather, the three faces of Julianne Moore. My question is, Sean, do we have decades more of Julianne Moore roles to enjoy?
I sincerely hope so. I mean, she's 56. I give her 30 more years... at least. I mean, Jane Fonda's turning 90 next year.
Yeah, but Jane Fonda took a long time off where she was just making workout videos, and then she made Monster in Law.
And the world is a better place because of it.
No, but what I'm saying is, like, Julianne Moore is at the top of her game now, and she keeps surprising us, doing different things. You know, she does Kingsman, she does family films, she does Crazy Stupid Love, like, then she'll do a new Todd Haynes, like, she keeps throwing us new things. Will she eventually reach a Meryl place where she just gets lazy? Sorry, Michael. do you know what I mean? Will she reach a Nancy Meyers place where she just, like, doesn't want to do this anymore?
I don't think so.
She's that good, isn't she?
I think the only reason she would not do it is because, like, she becomes, a grandmother and she wants to spend more time with her grandkids or something.
You know, she writes children's books.
Yeah, she does, yeah. I can see her taking a break just because...
She doesn't take many breaks, so she's pretty much worked consistently.
Very long, yeah.
Yeah.
And because there's also still things like, you know, what Maisie knew and...
Which is an interesting film.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, to be honest, she also does plenty of product placements as well. I mean, she's not unafraid to do the various luxury brands.
It's true.
The woman works a lot.
Yeah.
And we are the better for it. Well, that has been Julianne Moore, The Good, the Bad, and the Crazy. And I didn't plan it, Sean, but Monster in Law is a very good segue to the next actress we'll be looking at in 2 weeks' time. Nope, it's not Jane Fonda, although she would be a great one. It's maybe a surprising choice.
Yeah, it's Jennifer Lopez.
J-Lo.
J-Lo, yeah.
Singer, actress.
Entrepreneur.
Mogul, and Puerto Rican role model.
And brand spokeswoman of the world.
She's just Jenny from the block, and we are going to investigate, because although we don't think of it now, she has given some really good performances, as well as some bad and crazy.
Yeah, I can't wait for it.
Until then, we're just out of sight.
Bye.